Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. It is another packed show, and in reverse order, in a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, retired, who's everything. He's a Renaissance guy. He's a soldier. He's a citizen. He's a dad. He's got this great book called If I Don't Return, and it happens to be there's a lot of stuff going on in his kind of world these days. And Jamie, your world. So we got him in a few minutes. He might have to leave us kind of early. And then we're also going to be talking in just a few minutes with Shane Mullen from Left Bank Books, which is we love independent bookstores here at Chatter. It is one of the most iconic. It is one of the hearts and souls of its community in St. Louis. And we'll talk to him. But first, I finally get to talk about my favorite random thing, which is, and there's a book connection here. Shane, don't laugh at us when we talk about this. Hockey romance books and heated rivalry. Mm-hmm. So David, Claude, this is seeped into your world, whether you mm-hmm. like it or not, both hockey and romance novels. So, and if you didn't see Saturday Night Live, people should watch last Saturday, Saturday Night Live, because Connor Story, one of the stars, was a host and he was quite good. Shane's nodding and said, did you watch, Shane?
I've only watched clips so far, but the clips that I've seen have been brilliant. My friend who stayed up way later than she
way
ever
too
does,
late.
Was so excited to see it.
Okay, we're dragging Shane into the show now. The opening monologue is usually painful because it's usually some famous celebrity who has poorly written material and they clearly haven't practiced and it's just painful to watch. He was really good in his opening monologue and then a couple of the skits. But David, hockey, romance, right up your alley, right, my friend?
No. It's fine. It doesn't have to be up my alley, Tori. It can be for whoever finds that enjoyable.
Yeah.
I'm not a hockey guy. I like watching hockey, but I don't know anything about the sport or the ethos of it. You know, I am sure that it resonates with, I'm sure, YA readers, right? I'm sure are all into this.
Honey. What's generations beyond
YA? No, what I mean
YA?
Is I don't mean like kids. I mean young adults, like literally people that are in college, right?
Let me represent, even though they're a few years behind me, the 50-year-old suburban moms.
Oh, them too.
Are they into it?
That'll be fine,
too. Oh, my God. Okay.
That's okay. Doesn't have to be for me.
I think the thing that is so fascinating about this phenomenon, and again, I think I said this before on the show, I'd say a year, year and a half ago, someone reached out to me and said, hey, there's this, you're a hockey fan, and there's this author, and she's got these really successful romance books, and I'm like, checking out. She was representing the woman who wrote the books from which Heated Rivalry was developed. I think one of the most successful streaming series ever.
So, Tori, David says he doesn't, he's not a big hockey fan, but neither are the readers of these books. It's not
That's
really
the thing.
Hockey. It's like the readers say, I'm not really into hockey, but the books. And when I read about this phenomenon, I was completely floored. I don't know, maybe like you, I had no idea this was a thing, but it's a big thing.
It's a very big thing, because if you got up in the morning and said, I'm going to write the great romance novel and tie it to a sport. Okay, wait, I'll put this in form of a question. Now, Claude has to go first and then David, because it's alphabetical order, and then Jamie, and then Shane, because in 1 minute, Shane has to loop in anyhow. So Claude, David, Jamie, Shane. If you were going to write, hypothetically speaking, if you were writing a romance novel, with which sport would you align it and why?
Claude. Well, for me, it would have to be golf, because I play it, I watch it, I follow it. I mean, I work for PGA Tour Radio. So that would have to be a part of it. By the way, I love this stuff with the novels. There was a Hallmark Channel Christmas movie surrounding, I think it was called Love on Course. There was also a pickleball Hallmark Channel. I think it was Christmas. These might not have been Christmas. They might have just been themed around. But then also you got to remember there was a hockey one with Hallmark Channel, and there was two football ones with Hallmark Channel.
Oh, the football ones are fantastic.
And I'm a Hallmark Channel Christmas movie / Hallmark Channel romance guy. So I don't, the book I didn't read. I love it. If you like it, I love it. for you, do your thing. However, this is what we do for those of us who love romance, love Hallmark, and love sports. We mix it together. So it would be golf, but I'm totally into it. Haven't done the hockey thing because it's not my thing. I wouldn't know what, I don't know what offsides means. I don't know what it means.
Right. It's so, stupid. It's stupid. Okay, it's David. You're gonna write a rom. You're gonna write a novel one of these days in my lifetime.
Somewhere in one of my computers, I have several chapters of a novel that I started to write 20 years ago about a football team and its gay quarterback. Awesome. So that was it's in there. So I got to find it. I don't know where it is, but it's in there somewhere. That was the whole point. Well, it wasn't the whole point. It's a murder mystery, actually, but. One of the central figures is a gay quarterback. So
does the gay quarterback get killed?
He can't reveal that now. He's going to make the
I didn't get that
eventually.
Okay,
and he'll have to
just establishing characters the first few chapters.
David is clearly going to be a seat of the pantser novel writer.
I am a seat of the pantser. Yes, absolutely.
The movie title will be fourth.
It would have to be an NFL book because that would first of all would drive Goodell crazy, which I like. I think that's wonderful.
Love it. Love it.
But secondly, everybody would buy it because people like football. So that's why.
Totally. Okay, Jamie, quickly.
Baseball definitely be baseball because that's the. That's the most it's the most romantic sport. It's, you know, there's so much going on there and it's not violent. And so it's, you know, I would set it in a pastoral baseball setting, maybe in spring training.
Iconic movie baseball scene. Bull Durham, Kevin Costner doing his soliloquy to Susan Sarandon.
Yes.
Very hot. Okay, Shane, we're 2 minutes over when we said we're going to talk to you about your great bookstore, but you're in now, baby. Come on.
This is a topic I could talk about for hours.
Go.
So love it. I would do synchronized diving because it is a sport that I love. It is a sport that many people are not familiar with. And you have the Tom Daly kind of do like a little innuendo towards it being about him. But also bobsled would be perfect for a romance series because you had the perfect number of books based upon each of the bobsledders. Mm-hmm.
That is
even though I don't know anything about bobsled.
You couldn't pick two more different sports, but that is perfect. Perfect. Okay. Could it be the diving? Would you have synchronized divers? Don't they do that as part of some of the diving?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that would be like the ice dancing thing.
Yeah.
Where the partners sleep with each other and everything else. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Shane's idea is the best idea. And you know why? The least clothing. You got to think about these things when you're bringing it to the big screen. You got to think about these things. Okay.
A lot of shower scenes.
Great. Okay. that topic has been on my list. Hockey and romance novels for months. So thank you very, very much. And when people are not listening to the podcast, we're buying books at wonderful places like Left Bank Books. They should watch Connor Story's opening monologue, Saturday Night Live. It was great. Okay. Shane, thank you so much for joining us. I know you've had a crazy several days scheduling all over the world, which is just nonsense. I mean, David, apologies for the scheduling snafu. Sorry. And they are participating in the pitch. And just a quick reminder, this is the writing competition fueled by independent bookstores. They nominate them. We judge them. Winner's going to get $5,000. Shane is going to come back in a little while with his nominated author or authors. But in the meantime, it's one of these stores we want to put a spotlight on. So Shane, how long with Left Bank Books, and give us the backstory on the store and why you're there.
So I've been with the bookstore for 15 years this summer. So
you're 12. How could you be at the store for 15 years?
I did work a little bit in other big box book selling before coming to Left Bank. So I have a little bit of experience outside of the indie bookstore world, but I have been in this world for what feels like a very long time, but also just the shortest amount of time, especially in consideration for how long the bookstore has been in existence. We were founded in 19...
It's almost 60 years?
Almost 60 years, yeah.
Yeah.
So we were formed by a cooperative of Washington University graduate students who were trying to make a place to find literature that they were not able to find anywhere else in St. Louis. Anti-war literature, Black literature, activists. So all of that was unable to be found anywhere else in St. Louis, including apparently the Rolling Stone. That was like
the
thing that you couldn't find anywhere else in St. Louis, but Left Bank Books had it. And so you can flash forward a little bit. We are now currently owned by Chris Kleindienst, who is queer and has been owner of the bookstore for 51 years, if I am not mistaken, and has worked at the bookstore for 53, something like this wildly
crazy
long amount of time. But she is the owner of the bookstore, and I just got to spend a week with her in Pittsburgh at a book conference where we got to hang out with other booksellers who have been in this as long as she has and get to see her just hanging out with friends, which is really kind of cool.
Okay, so one of the things that I found fascinating, looking, you know, reading some of the stuff that you've written and posted, is your official title is head of events for the bookstore, correct? But it seems like it's a lot more than that, and we will probably run out of time. But last year you were in Turin at a Booksellers Across Borders. This past week you were in Pittsburgh, my hometown, at a conference. Tell us about Pittsburgh first. What was it? What were you doing there? And it must have been, walking around with her must have been like walking around with the Pope.
Yeah. So I'm also on the board of Midwest Independent Booksellers. So I get to travel a little bit with them as well. But yes, it was an honor and a privilege to get to go to Italy for the Booksellers Across Borders. I was able to speak on the current state of banned books in the US, which was something that they were aware of, but weren't aware of like how bad it has gotten, because they see the headlines, they see like some of the like kind of bigger issues, but they didn't know that it was everywhere. And I similarly got to speak about that at Winter Institute, which was last week. I did a panel on author events and censorship. So the importance of producing these events for underrepresented voices, how to combat schools that are uncertain about the reaction that some of the parents are going to have against some of these books. So censorship and book banning, beyond just being someone who's been doing events, producing events for a while, is another thing that I'm very passionate about in the book world.
So how do we stack up? So you're in Turin, you're in developed country, you're in developed part of the world. How do we stack up in terms of banned books? How do we stack up vis-a-vis them?
Well, so they are starting to, especially in the UK, they've been seeing some of the information, some of the kind of what they've been using to ban books here in the US has been infiltrating, especially in the UK, and beginning to go into Europe. So all of the language, everything they are copy and pasting and trying to do in those countries as well. I am not an expert by any means on beyond that. I don't have, I have friends that work in the UK bookselling world, but not in Asia or places like that.
Yeah.
I know that they have their own difficulties, and some countries have
more than others.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
One of the things I've seen you written about, which I thought was so interesting, you go to these big events and you went to some, I think it was in Turin maybe, you went to, you're wandering around the beautiful city and you see different bookstores, and you like that you can identify publishers. And you talked about the ability of somebody to say, this is a publisher that is doing good works in something I care about, an area we care about, et cetera. Can you talk about that a little bit? I've never seen that perspective before.
So we do have a little bit of that here in the US, especially with some of the smaller presses, where you can look at a book and they have, even if the cover is slightly different, they will have almost a uniformity of design.
Sure.
And when you've read like two or three books from that publisher and know that you can trust them, trust what they are trying to do for the world of literature, it's very easy for me to, even if they're in a different section. So like if I'm looking in fiction, but then wander over to history and I can find, oh, like I recognize that spine, I recognize that
sure.
a certain book, a certain publisher.
Interesting. Who are your favorites?
I have really been loving Grove. Dinner with Douglas Stewart last week, and his book is going to be huge this year. He obviously won a ton of awards for Shuggie Bane, but John of John was one of the books that was most discussed at this conference. I really like what Europa has been doing. Mm-hmm. Other Press is kind of pretty small, but they are really publishing some really fantastic fiction and nonfiction, mostly in translation. But then, of course, like, you know, I love Tor. And when I want to read sci-fi, I go to Tor and pick up some of their books. A lot of their books are queer. A lot of them are like shorter. They like just pack a lot of meat in there. So.
I love it. It's like, it's really interesting. I mean, David, it's like knowing there's a team that you really like, and you like the management. You're like, it was fascinating to me because I never thought about it. Okay, give us, before we let you go, Shane, give us a little hint about why you all agreed to participate in the pitch, and a hint, without revealing the names yet, a hint of the author, maybe authors that you might nominate.
Sure. I mean, essentially, I will do anything that Ron Charles tells me to do. So.
There we go. Perfect. Perfect. Us too.
It's like, okay. This must be fine. This must be good. Why not?
What is it you love about Ron Charles as a critic?
He stops into the bookstore and I am able to chat with him about books. He is always able to recommend something that hasn't been on my radar before.
Yeah.
And it is always one of the best books that I will read that year. Mm-hmm. So I just trust him. And like, we've had this relationship, so like, he kind of knows what I like to read. I kind of know what he likes to read.
Right.
It is impossible to sell him a book because he has gotten all of them. He knows way more about any book than I do, which is incredible.
Yeah.
But I have selected my two books, which are behind me, and I'm really excited to present them. One is a St. Louis author who is a recent transplant, who has mostly been writing in the middle grade kind of fantasy series. And we are going to be talking about his standalone, which is incredible. And then an Iowa author who is celebrating, I believe it's their second book. So I'm very excited to talk about
awesome. Okay. As David and Claude have learned painfully over the last few days, my scheduling has been really screwed up lately, but I'm going to come back to you this week. And we can figure out when you can come back with one or both of the authors, okay? Shane,
Perfect.
Let's thank folks. Anybody, everybody listening in the Midwest, you have a chance to go through St. Louis, great city. Go to this bookstore. It is fantastic. So thank you, Shane.
We are one of the 150 bookstores to see before you die. So, yeah.
That's a great list. That's like going to the Major League Baseball parks.
Nice.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks, man. General, how are you?
I'm well, Tori. How are you? Long time no see.
Really long time. Okay, Major General Mark Hertling, it's really an honor to have you with us. The timing couldn't be, you know, more perfect or challenging or whatever, but thank you so much for being here. And we really, really want to spend a lot of time on your book. I think you know Jamie McIntyre. I don't know how the pictures show up on the top of your screen, but you know Jamie McIntyre.
Yeah. I know Jamie. I don't know the other two gentlemen.
Okay. David Aldridge. He's like to the sports world. He's like you, only bigger.
Oh, wow. Okay. I feel bad for you, David.
No, it's nice. It's nice to meet you, sir.
And then Claude Jennings is the only person you care about because he's the one that makes this whole show run. So
great. Hey, who were you just talking to? I heard St. Louis before we started.
Yeah, you were from St. Louis, right?
I am, and I'm going out there late April.
It's called Left Bank Books. They've been there for almost 60 years. It is a heart and soul of the community. Really, really cool people. Shane Mullen does events, but he does a lot more for them. And they're part of this writing competition we're doing. But the way I got connected with Left Bank Books wasn't really Ron Charles, the Washington Post, even though Shane thought that. It was Tom Shanker, New York Times, used to cover.
Well, he's who hooked me up with you, too. Tom's a dear friend of mine. Yeah.
There we go. Tom, little connector.
Okay. Tom and I once, he was embedded with me in Iraq for a long time, about 6 months. And after the war, after we came back, he asked me if I'd write an article with him. So we wrote an article called the Military Media Relationship. It's a dysfunctional marriage, but we stay in it for the kids, was the name of the piece.
That's so great. That's exactly what it is. Okay, we can't. I traded emails with the general earlier today, and I said, we really want to spend time talking about the book if I don't return, because it's amazing. But we got to just touch briefly on what's going on in the world right now, Iran and Middle East. And Jamie, try to contain your excitement and your long-winded questions. Just try. Two things have struck me, maybe three things. One, if you've been at all involved with something like this, and you far more than any of us, of course, the first thing you know is you know nothing. You might watch everything, you might read everything, but whatever is publicly available, you still know nothing.
Right.
Second thing that struck me is, especially in the early phases of these kinds of things, there's so many images flying by, the news media, God bless them, doing their best, but it's numbers and it's just words. And I thought to myself, these are young men and women doing incredible things, doing really dangerous things. Some of them have already lost their lives. That was my one thought, to which I'd like you to just maybe briefly reflect. And the second one is people, I think they want to oversimplify what an operation like this is. Oh, we're going to go in and, you know, smack the heck out of them.
Well, and the people that are saying that have never done it.
Right.
It's the ones who have done it will never say something like that.
Yeah.
And to your first point, I don't know if you know about this, but three of us have this. Marty Dempsey, Mike Scaparati, and I, we were together in Baghdad in 2003 and four. And Dempsey was the division commander. And what he had his aide do every time we lost a soldier is he would produce, the aide would produce a card that looked something like this. And it has the picture of the individual on it. On the back, it has details of what happened, as well as, the next of kin and some of the people who are associated with him. If he was a parent, if he had children, where he was born, that kind of stuff. After that deployment was over, I was in a cigar store in Virginia Beach, and I found a box. And one of the things General Dempsey did, who I admire greatly, and he's my best friend, he was trying to, exhibit to his soldiers, sort of a mantra of some type after each one of the memorial services we would have in Iraq. And he finally came up with the only thing he could say to the soldiers was, make it matter. Make this death matter. Make this sacrifice matter. So I was in the cigar store and there were these wooden boxes. And I asked the guy if he could engrave make it matter on the top. So I bought three of them, gave one to Marty, gave one to Mike Scap, and kept one for myself. And we continued to put these cards in the box. And I'm going to hold this up and try not to drop any of these things out of here. But this is my box now with 253 cards of soldiers that paid the ultimate sacrifice under me when I was in command later on, and as well as in Baghdad. And every day I open this box, pick two or three out of them, and take a look at their pictures. And of course, in 2004 and 2008, they were 18 or 19 years old. Well, they would have been 30 or 40 years old today. They would have had a family. I don't know if they would have been divorced or remarried or, had eight kids or, were a school teacher or something like that. And you think of what could have been. And every day when you try and live your life, you go back to the expression of make it matter. So it gives you a higher calling than just waking up every morning and doing your thing. And it kind of gives you a little bit of guidance. Marty's talked about that quite a bit with a bunch of people. I've talked about it a couple of times, but it's the equivalent expression of in Saving Private Ryan when Tom Hanks pulls Matt Damon into him and says, earn this. This is our earn it. You've got to be good for those people who didn't make it back. Those are the kinds of things that I think many of our political leaders don't understand when they're sending young people off to war.
It's a mic drop moment, and we should just stop the show now. and go, okay, everybody just go out and buy.
Our producer would stop.
Well, I do actually talk about the box in the book for a little bit.
Yeah. And it'll be in the Netflix series. When they do the Netflix series, it'll be in there. It absolutely will be in there. Yeah. Okay. We got to do a little bit of your backstory. Cause you've just had just an incredible career and it would take forever to go through the whole thing. But St. Louis, we know. Why the military? Why West Point?
Cause I grew up in a poor family and I had a high school guidance counselor who said, hey, and this was in 1971. So it was the height of the Vietnam, or right after the height of the Vietnam War. And this guidance counselor came up to me and he says, you're not going to be able to afford college, but you've got some potential. Why don't you go to this place called West Point? And so
did you know anything about it?
I did. I knew a little bit about it. And there's a story to that, too. But I thought, yeah, it's not a bad idea. It's a good way to get an education. And I had applied to a couple other schools. I tried to get a sports scholarship. I was a swimmer and a water polo player, but I had a couple partial scholarships, one to Notre Dame and one to Purdue, and they didn't come through. Mm-hmm. So for the first time on an airplane and the first time in my life leaving St. Louis, I boarded a jet on the 1st of July or the 30th of June, 1971, and flew to New York and stayed overnight in the city and then drove up on a bus to the academy and started a career. And my first day there, it was like, what the hell have I gotten myself into? and it was all uphill from there. So anyway, that's my early story and seeing something new and starting into a military career. And as you know, it's a 4-year education with a 5-year commitment afterwards. And that 5-year commitment turned into 38 years in the Army because I liked the people. I liked what we were doing. It was a constant challenge. It was fun. And I was seeing the world. And for that kid who had never been on an airplane until he went off to school, since then, I've been to 123 different countries and seen the world. So there's that part of it that's kind of cool.
I have a PDF, Mark's book. I'm going to hold this up for News Channel 8. I've got little stickies on my favorite things. I hope I can get back to the Mark Twain quote about travel because I agree. Let's see the real cover.
So here's the book.
There nice.
And here's the original journal that it came from with my handwritten stuff inside of it and a couple of, Iraqi dinars and some other things. But yeah, that's the backstory.
The backstory in the book, take us back to the Christmas morning when your son presented you with something that started this all.
Yeah, well, I'll start off why I started to write the journal first, because it played into that. But in 1990, when we were told we were going to deploy on CNN, by the way, on AFN, AFN, we were in Germany. We were told to watch the news that night, and Secretary Cheney came on and said, we're sending the 7th Corps to Iraq to reinforce the 82nd Airborne Division. And the next day, or within the first couple of days, I was in a cavalry squadron, which means we were going to be a reconnaissance unit out in front of the division. And within a couple of days, while we were getting our intelligence briefings on what we were going to do, we were told that we, the cavalry, would probably suffer 50% casualties. And that was because we were going up against the 4th largest army in the world at the time. Saddam had just come out of an 8-year war with Iran. He had used chemical weapons on his own people in Halabja. So we were told, hey, it's going to be a tough fight. As it turned out, it wasn't. But I started thinking, I've got an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. What do I do for them if I don't come back? If I've got
two boys.
Mm-hmm. If I've got a coin flip chance of coming back. So as soon as I arrived in the deserts of Saudi Arabia, I started writing a page journal every day about bizarre subjects. Of just so they started learning about who I was and what we were doing. So that turned into the journal. The spoiler alert, when I did come home, we made it through. We had a couple people wounded during the war. I was one of them. But when we came home, the boys were still, they were now 9 and 11 when I came home. And they didn't want anything to do with a journal that I had written that had all these deep thoughts. So I threw it in a footlocker and forgot about it. a couple of years ago, our youngest son, Scott, who has had multiple tours himself in Iraq. Our oldest son is still in the Army. He's at Fort Hood right now, commanding a brigade. But Scott asked my wife where the journal was. She gave it to him, and unbeknownst to me, he started typing it up in a Word document and inserting pictures. Christmas of 24, after, you know, we had had several cups of coffee with Kahlua in it, and, you know, the kids were, the grandkids were running around crazy. The kids went off to play with their new Lego, and Scott and I were in the living room, and he just approached me with this box, and he said, "Hey, Dad, this gift is just for you. I wanted to wait for all the other gifts to be done where it was just me and you." I opened it up, and I saw this document, and as you can imagine, it was an emotional moment. But all the sights and smells and sounds of the desert started coming back. And then he said, "You know, my brother and I realized why you were doing this. You were preparing us in case you didn't come home." He said, "And it's a great document of your life during that period of time. But now you've got 5 grandsons and 2 granddaughters. Why don't you expand this and talk about your life since then and leave it as a gift to us?" So that's the story. And truthfully, Tori, I don't think he thought I was going to do it because he knows I'm a procrastinator. But it turned into a really cool project.
Okay, well, we will, and I want to talk about the project. And again, I have so many questions. Here's what our so-called grown children say to us. Things like, "When you die, do we get the house? Do we get?" They're not looking. They are smart enough to know. Don't get any lessons from me. My big takeaway from "If I Don't Return," because Jamie always schools me, General, that I got to mention the name of the book a lot.
Can you call me Mark, Tori?
No. I know how much work. I'm a firm believer. I know how much work it takes to get all those shiny things on your shoulder. And I just think, okay, I'm sticking with it. Plus, okay, when people overhear me and I'm talking to General so-and-so, I sound important.
Okay, there you go.
But I was reading through this whole thing, and then I was driving my husband crazy because I kept going, "Oh my God, we never told our kids this. Oh my God, we never told our kids that. We never left." So We're going to try to catch up. Okay. I'll work backwards. Of these lessons in "If I Don't Return," which ones did you feel most passionately about at the time? And then as you were working in this book, because the way it's structured, everybody, is it's the actual transcript of what you had in the journal from 1990, 1991, and right, then your reflection on it with kind of a current perspective. Which one was the most important to you? Because I've got crying.
Oh, gosh.
I've got travel. I've got friendship. I've got make it matter. Which one worked for you?
You know, I really think the biggest one that I didn't write a whole lot about was the change from personal fear to personal responsibility. You know, going into this as a young major, seeing combat for the first time and having a young family, and, you know, it was a introspection of, gosh, I might not come back. I might not drink another beer again. I might not ride bicycles with my wife and my kids. I might not throw a ball with our growing kids. And it was fear. I mean, all soldiers have that until they see the proverbial elephant. But then in later deployments, and with an understanding of the lessons I learned from that first combat, which was very tough. I mean, most people think Desert Storm was a cakewalk. It was not for us, but it was intense and short, which was good. But in later deployments, in different roles, it turned from fear for personal safety into responsibility for others. And an understanding that I mean, you get to the point when you first go through combat, you know, you're running for the bomb shelters when sirens go off and all those kind of things, to knowing, you know, if it's your day, you're going to go, you know, nothing's going to stop it. Doesn't matter how fast you run, the bomb shelter might get hit, you know, or you're moving somewhere and get hit there. Later on, it's more, boy, I've got these hundreds and in some cases thousands of people that I'm responsible for, like the ones in the box here, and you take on a different perspective of what your role is. It's not protecting yourself. It's bringing other people home. So that was my, I think, my biggest lesson.
Did that shape your leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. David, Jamie, jump in, because I tend to talk too much, General. Okay. An SEE, a significant emotional event. Nothing like the military. Nothing like the military and acronyms. Nothing like the Army and acronyms.
Yeah.
Who are the all-time best / worst. And I will just tell the story, then David, go to you. My dear friend George Rheindance, my chief of staff, Army colonel, fantastic guy. POV, acronym in the military. Point. For privately owned vehicle.
Right.
And he said to me, ma'am, only the Army could take a word like car and turn it into privately owned vehicle, but then turn it back to POV. But anyway, yeah. David.
And how about BFO? You know, BFO?
Just BFO.
BFO is a blinding flash of the obvious. You know, when people are when people are telling you things you already know, I thought, oh, that's a BFO. Let's move on.
LRB. Do you know LRB?
I don't.
Little red button.
I don't know what that is.
Well, something bad's happening. Somebody's going to hit the little red button.
Oh, okay. All right.
There you go. It's a new one. Okay, okay, David.
I was deferring to Jamie.
Sorry.
I feel it is Bailey. Wait, let him go.
Jamie's
first.
Dying, by the way. He is dying.
I'm fascinated by two. The one is that I'm about the same age that you are, Lieutenant General. And I'm going through this thing about writing things that I wonder if my kids are going to want to read or not. But I'm also really curious about how you see what's going on now with the, you know, you talked about writing an article with Tom Shanker about the military media relationship, the dysfunctional marriage. Well, they didn't stay together for the kids anymore. It's been a big divorce, big difference from when Tory was at the Pentagon.
Yeah, that's for sure.
When we went to war. And I'm curious about this, the attitude of the new administration toward the press, which is that, you know, we're the enemy. And we had so many cases where previous secretaries of defense did not consider the press the enemy, the mainstream press, as we like to call it. And I'm just wondering about your thoughts about, will it ever go back to the way it was, where you had a reporter with you for 6 months during war? And now we have a war going on and there are no reporters given any access to anything.
Well, I certainly hope so, because it's talked about in our Constitution. You know, the ability, I mean, the only two organizations that are mentioned in the Constitution are the Army and the press.
Correct.
And truthfully, Jamie, as you know, we were together a little bit in the Pentagon the one time I was there, I met you. And, you know, frankly, the media is a pain in the ass, but you have to tell the story because you're responsible to the American people for what you do. And as many embeds as I had in my career in combat, there were some I absolutely loved. Tom Shanker was one. Michael Holmes was another. Mm-hmm. Jane Araff was a true pain in the ass, but she was a great reporter. And you know, you wanted to tell her the story because she got it right. And it had to do with how you develop that trust. So, you know, the reporters who are going to report the truth, and sometimes it pokes you in the eye, but that's okay. I had, you know, in a conversation one time, I can't remember who it was with, and it had to do in Baghdad in 2003. General Dempsey was the division commander. Mike Scaparotti and I were the two assistant division commanders. And Dempsey was so good. What he did was he gave us a list of things that were our responsibilities. And the first responsibility on both lists were make the brigade commanders successful. And then the rest of the list was our individual responsibilities. One of the things he gave me interact with the media. And it wasn't just U.S. media. It was foreign media. It was, you know, the international, the Arab media, which was a pain. The folks back home in Germany that were reporting to our families. So I kind of took that on, and I got to sort of know what journalists were all about. And if you create that trust, good things happen because you can tell the story and you can help the American people understand. Tom Shenker, we were talking the other day because I talked to his class at Georgetown about the relationship. We're still really good friends. And, you know, the reason the trust developed an opportunity for me to bring him into the tent before a couple of major operations and say, here's what we're going to do. You can get the backstory, but then don't say anything until we do it. And then once we do it, you can report whatever you want and in whatever way you want. But it was only because of the trust that we did that. We had other reporters who were immediately going for the deadline and really kind of screwing things up, truthfully. So I wouldn't let them in the tent.
I had a lot of experiences like that where there was some mutual respect, I would say. And I was privy to a lot of things that that really informed my reporting. One quick story about Tom Shenker, since we've mentioned him.
Got to be really quick, Jamie, because Hurtling is very popular today, and he's got
That's why I've got the tie on right now.
Just really quick.
But okay. I do have to tell you, I've got gym shorts on at the bottom, so, you know.
Like when I was anchoring in college.
There you go.
So Tom's in the hallway of the Pentagon. He's being berated by this general who's complained to him that the New York Times is the most inaccurate paper. And Tom says, I don't know how you can say that. And he says, well, I look at the Times every morning and the corrections page, they've got more corrections in the Times than in any other news organization. And I had to laugh about it because, of course, the reason was the Times was very attuned to making corrections when things wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Story.
Well, your original question, Jamie, I think it's an important question to answer. We have got to get back to the trust between them. And the whole thing that is going on in the Pentagon press room is just an aberration. It should not be happening. And it's showing right now. We don't know what the hell's going on.
Right.
So
yeah. And I always say, you know, pendulum swing, and back so many years ago when we had the embedding program in Iraq, 2003, and people said, oh, my God, you know, most transparency, most cooperation, not agreement, cooperation, et cetera, that genie will never be put back in the bottle. And I said, well, I don't know. Right. And right now the genie's been put back in the bottle. But I think pendulum swing. David Aldridge, I see you nodding your head a lot. Before
I do,
let the general go on.
I like to listen and learn. General, I Tory, of course, stole the thing I was going to talk about, which was the SEE and the significance of that for people who have been in combat. It is a different type of combat today than it was when you got to Iraq in 1990 and 91.
Absolutely.
It doesn't mean it's better. It means it's different. And I wonder what lessons you took and what any soldier would take when you are in uniform and you look across through whatever means you look across and you see people in another uniform who are shooting at you. And you know what they're trying to do, and they know what you're trying to do. And it's just a matter of who's more efficient on that given day.
Yeah.
And now it's war by drone. It's war by other means. It's not armies lining up with tanks against each other.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, like, that appropriate fear, they talk about that in a very different context in sports. You have to have appropriate fear of the team you're playing, because if you don't respect them, they will beat you. In the Army, I'm sure that means if you don't respect the Army, they will kill you. So how does a modern Army deal with appropriate fear when they don't have to face it the way you all did?
They face it in different ways, though. I think you talk to the folks in Ukraine, and I have, about the drone warfare right now. That is scary as hell because you can't hide. You know, there's no running away.
Right.
So that's a different kind of fear, of which we're learning, and we're not real good at that just yet. I mean, we have the technological capabilities, but we haven't experienced that being hunted by a drone or a robot. So, David, I kind of think, you know, we're going to replace one type of fear with another.
Right. You know, that's the drones are a big fear of the unknown.
Sure. Yeah. It's always the unknown that you're afraid of. Right. Are the missiles coming in at Mach 3 that you don't even see and you don't even hear? Right. You know, the big thing that we saw, well, I mean, the Ukrainians saw it up front and personal, but the anti-tank warfare from 5,000 meters away when a anti-tank missile is shot at you, you don't see it coming. I mean, you're in this little, you know, 70-ton cage surrounded by armor, and this thing's coming off your flank, and you don't even know it's coming out there, and suddenly you're obliterated. You don't even know you're in a fight. So to apply the sports analogy, it's like going in a boxing ring and not knowing you have an opponent there. And it's just a different kind of intelligence. And that's one of the things I think I talk about in the book is how intelligence changed over the years, and how reconnaissance has changed. I mean, we were a cavalry squadron conducting what was then called a meeting engagement. We were feeling out the enemy. It was kind of the same as Buford on horseback during the Civil War. Today, if you're in a meeting engagement, you're doing something wrong because you better know what's out there first before you go out there. So those are the other thing I'll tell you that I was telling to somebody the other day. I went to an event and I told it was about 30 minutes away, and I plugged in the address in my GPS in my car, and I got there. We didn't have GPS in 1991. So we were going, and I talk about this in the book, going across the desert with a boat compass and a chem light on the end of our gun tube. Man, the evolution in just intelligence and maneuver and technologies is off the chart. And it's going to make warfare much harder and I think much scarier for the folks of this generation as opposed to my generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Much more challenging. Okay, Claude, last one.
Yeah, so your son presents the Word document to you of your journal, says, you know, reflect on it, give it back to us and the grandkids as a gift. I can, you know, assume you started with that in mind. But then at some point, did it become, you know, maybe not even therapeutic for you, but like, did you learn something about yourself from that moment that you didn't realize until you started to just like write it out in a way to explain to them?
Claude, I'll tell you two things that was good about this book. It didn't need an outline because in every subject, I immediately had flashes of things I wanted to write. I mean, taking the subjects and as you know, if you looked at it, it goes from the sublime to the ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, at one time I'm talking about fear, the other time I'm talking about MREs. I'm talking about chaplains and at the same time talking about culture. These were love letters to my kids back in 1991. And I think what I wanted to do, and this evolved from my 10 years with CNN, because during that period of being a military analyst, I realized, and it gets back to what Tori was saying, how little the American people know about the military. You know, that only 1% serve today. So that means 99% of Americans don't have a clue in depth of what we do because they've never done it. So it became a bigger love letter, not just to my grandchildren, but back to the American public, to talk not just about combat and warfare. And you know, that's a relatively small part of the book. It talks about life and love and character and emotions and everything in between. My publisher said, this isn't a war book. He said, this is a first leadership book. Then it's a family book. And then it's sort of a memoir, but it's not, because I've never really wanted to write a leadership book that there are so many on the market of, boy, aren't I great? And here are all the wonderful things I did. Because when you read the book, you realize I didn't do that many wonderful things. I just happened to be at different places. But the last thing it was is a description of combat. But that description, I think, is pretty intense. So this is more of a lesson about family and love and character and leadership, and then a lesson about the military.
Agree completely, and your publisher was brilliant. It's a gift. It's clearly a gift to your sons and to your family. Mm-hmm. And really encourage people to pick this up, you know, things are coming up. Holidays, Father's Day.
Can I share something with you? So I have an MBA class that I teach at a local college. And I've got a great group of people in it. There's 15 executives in this group. And I had a book signing at the local library yesterday. All of them showed up with a bunch of other people. And they bought the book, an advanced copy, and I signed it for everybody. One of the young women in the class who knows nothing about the military, she thanked me for it. She went home. She called me this morning. She said, I was up all night reading this. I'm a girl. I know nothing about the military. I'm a business person. And she said, this just floored me in terms of I laughed, I cried, I, you know, the whole deal. So that was kind of cool to hear that from a young woman who just said this was something different. And she said it's the best book I've ever read, which is high praise from this gal.
So nice.
And I'm using that to hawk my book right now, as you probably
know. Of course, as you should. No, everybody. OK, General, I know you've got to go off and talk about important things happening in important parts of the world. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. One, thank you for your service. People don't thank people in the military enough. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for writing this book. And it really is. It is a gift. It is a gift to your family. It is a gift to anybody for putting things in perspective and life lessons on so many different things. It was really, really fabulous. If we had more time, we would subject you to 60 seconds more, which is this embarrassing
thing. Oh, I got 9 minutes. Give me 60. Oh, give me a couple.
Okay, David, can I do it?
Why?
60 seconds more, David, takes 11 minutes.
Okay, quick. Favorite childhood book.
Favorite childhood book?
Yeah.
West Point Plebe.
Written by what age did you read that?
I read it in grade school, actually, and it was my first taste of, and it has a great story behind it. Can I tell the story behind it? And then we'll finish.
Sure. It's your time.
The name of the author is a guy named Red Reeder, and I had no clue who Red Reeder was. Well, it turns out Red Reeder was a colonel in the Army, and he lost a leg at Normandy. He was a regimental commander at Normandy. So Omar Bradley and Reeder played baseball together at West Point. So Bradley said, hey, Red, and Red was just one of the heroes of the day. He was going to be a 4-star general. He said, hey, Red, I'm sending you back because you're an amputee. I'm sending you back to be a coach at West Point. So Reeder went back to West Point to coach. And there was a guy by the name of Fred Franks, who you know, I'm sure, General Fred Franks, who was a baseball player at West Point. As a major in Vietnam, he crawled into a hole after a bunch of Viet Cong. One of them threw a grenade. It blew his leg off. So he was in the hospital at Valley Forge, and Red Reeder came to visit him. And he said, Fred, what can I do for you? We've got the same injury. And General Frank said, Red, the only thing you can do for me is make sure I stay in the Army. And Reeder said, you can't do that. You're an amputee. And he says, make it happen. That's all I want to do. I want to stay a soldier. So Reeder called his friend, Omar Bradley, who was still alive, who was also a baseball player, 5-star general. Bradley intervenes. Franks gets to stay in the Army and goes from major to 4-star general and leads Desert Storm. He's my mentor. During my time working as a speechwriter for Fred Franks, he introduced me to Red Reeder. And here's the best part of the story. So Reeder died a few years ago. He's buried at West Point in the cemetery. He's got a tombstone that says Colonel, I can't remember his first name, Colonel Red Reeder, Silver Star, Legion of Merit, got all of his awards. And then it says Normandy, World War I in Normandy, or World War II. And it says, on the bottom, it says soldier, author, coach. His wife is buried right next to him. And on her, and I met her too, she's a beautiful woman. It says Dorothea Reeder, Red's editor. That's the only thing it says about her.
Wow,
that's my wife. She's my editor. She helped me with the book. So I think that's a great story.
That's fantastic. So how's that? Okay, best childhood book ever. Okay, we'll do this really quickly. Favorite classic book or least favorite classic book?
The Things They Carried is my favorite.
Okay.
By a guy named Tim O'Brien.
Good one. Okay. Favorite, I know you're a wartime movie, but favorite wartime movie?
Oh, Saving Private Ryan.
Because?
Best movie ever. The emotions and the reality of it and the final message, truthfully, the earn this message. it's worth the price of admission, as well as the first 20 minutes of landing at Normandy. And every veteran I've ever talked to who fought at Normandy, and I've talked to a lot of them, said that was exactly what it was like. That Spielberg got it right on that one.
Yeah, he often gets things right, but I've talked to people in the military, both people who were there or had relatives at Normandy, and they go, that's the closest to reality we've ever seen. Okay, last one. Of the blurbs on your book, I love Bill McCraven's blurb, A Timeless Tale of This Is About, If I Don't Return. Jamie, I haven't said the name of the book enough. Yeah. If I Don't Return. But this is what McCraven wrote. A timeless tale of life as a soldier, a father, and a wartime leader. Of those three, what's been the hardest for you personally?
Father.
Because?
Because it's the most important job you do. Our two sons are awesome fathers. And I keep telling them, I wish I had been as good as they are today with their kids. They're awesome. They're just, you know, I didn't have the right balance between the military and family. I, you know, was working too hard.
And
all of us are, you know, all of us do that. But they are just so good with their kids, and their kids are awesome too. I love their kids. So that's kind of cool.
I think they probably learned something from the old man. I think mm-hmm. a little bit. All right. General,
maybe.
Again, thank you for service. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for this great book. Everyone
thank
should
you.
Go buy it from their
independent. Good to see.
It's available March 10th, March 17th.
March 10th.
March 10th. It is available, but you can pre-order now if you want.
You can David. Pre-order from Ballast Books. They'll get it to you the next day, and it'll be a signed copy. How's
excellent.
That?
Cool. Okay, great.
All right, I'm
David
being called
Jamie,
by...
Come on. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you all.
Bye, everybody. Bye.